Hey friends, coming up on Tort, I'm in the steam-powered man cave. Yeah, we're talking to Frank Foti, Il Padrino, the chairman of the Telus Alliance, about audio processing, the anniversary of Z100's worst to first, and what's ahead for processing in the future. Next on Tort.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the Ruby console from Lavo, see Lavo and your future at lavo.com/twert. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by the Calrec Type R console system. Type R is a brand new, modular, expandable IP-based radio system from Calrec Audio.
Welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. And the guy who's been to the top of the tower in several cities is Frank Foti. Frank's our guest. We're going to get to welcome in. Glad you're here.
Well, Kirk, thank you for this opportunity to be here. And I know you guys had to juggle some things to do it at a different time today because I've got a bit of a crazy schedule, and I'm appreciative to you and your whole crew.
Thank you. We're going to have a good time for the next hour as Frank's going to give us some great, not only some stories about some adventures in the past, but also he'll cover audio processing and how it relates to super high quality audio that is recognized and revered by some of the top audio specialists in the world. Not just Frank, not just my ears or your ears, but I mean the ears of some really super people. So That's coming up. Hey, I want to bring in our co-host from New York, Chris Tobin. Welcome in, Chris. How are you?
I'm well. Good morning, everyone. I hope this is turning out to be a nice morning for all. I know here in the New York Metro, it's a nice sunny day, so I'm having a good time.
It is a great day. And Chris, I believe you and Frank will end up having a couple words to share about New York radio since you, you and Frank aren't too different in age. So maybe you were around in the early Z100 worst to first days.
1984. I remember I was working for two college stations as a contract engineer. Yeah. Worst to first with the agree balloon. Oh, yeah. Who doesn't remember that?
Actually, Chris, it was 1983. And if a little shout out and an early happy birthday to Z100 because tomorrow it's 36 years.
Oh my gosh. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, sorry, 1983. Sorry, 1983 is correct.
Yep.
We'll talk about that. If you've watched the show at all, you know who I am. I'm Kirk Harnack. I work for the Telus Alliance. And so if I say something really nice about Telus products, it's because I know what they are. So, yeah, there's a built-in bias. So we're going to talk about equipment, audio processing.
Everybody says something nice about the Telus Alliance because this Bozzini business, you know, Chris and I, we took care of some business out there in the Bronx not too long ago. And, Kirk, I'm drinking more iced tea than I used to. I'm sorry to have interrupted you on your broadcast.
You know, what you don't see on set here is behind Frank's desk, there are a couple of empty 5-gallon buckets, and there's a sack of Quikrete.
This is how we handle the competition in our world. It goes back to the days, you know, the trucks, you know, you, me, and your father, we were just to take care of some of these broadcasters and up at the top of the Empire State Building. And I don't know much about bodies flying off of the 83rd floor, but we can talk about that if you wish.
It was an accident. It was wet on the veranda. They slipped. That's the railing let go. It happens.
That's right. This is, you know.
Oh. What time did we lose control of the show, Frank?
Kirk, in 63 years, I've never had control, buddy.
All right. We got a sponsor, a couple of sponsors that are going to talk about our show, and we'll continue with Frank Foti and Chris Tobin's here. I'm here. We're at the world headquarters of the Telus Alliance. We're actually in Frank's lab. That's where we're doing the show from, so an hour of great stuff is coming up.
It's actually the steam-powered man cave.
Steam-powered man cave. That's right. Hang on. We'll be back with more in just a minute.
Calrec Type R is a modular, expandable IP-based radio system featuring three slimline panels, a fader panel, a large soft panel, and a small soft panel easily configured to give the operator full control. Layouts are saved and recalled quickly between shows. A single 2RU core with integrated I/O gets customers up and running fast, and that single core can power up to three independent mixing environments with no sharing of DSP resources. Available in 4 DSP packs, and as your station grows, larger packs can be added, enabling it to grow with you. Power to the surface is supplied via standard PoE switches, keeping cabling to a minimum. Type R is fully AES-67 compatible, as defined by SMPTE 2110, which means that it is also compliant with NMOS discovery and connection management specs. All these features combined make Type R the most flexible radio console you can buy. Find out more at calrec.com/twert.
Thanks a lot to CalRec for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech, and the website is calrec.com. You may have heard about a certain company that's been in the broadcast equipment business for decades, and that company was Radio Systems, and they've closed their doors. The proprietor is moving on to other things. And however, a lot of folks are wondering, well, where do I get those adapters to connect, you know, broadcast gear, XLR, whether it be analog like this, or whether it is actually AES digital audio. Where do I get these? And the answer is they're still being made in the same factory as before. Now, these are Studio Hub compatible adapters. So these are, a lot of people call them dongles. I think the right name is adapters. But the folks at Angry Audio are now making these Studio Hub compatible adapters. So the name is gone, but the format lives on. So this is a if you've wired anything in the last,
is that RCA?
Yeah, it's exactly. Excellent. Yeah, I wonder who owns.
I'm showing my age there. You know, the what was RCA and the something's gone, but the name lives on. Or that,
yeah, that's right. And weren't these at one time called Canon connectors? Instead of XLR?
Yeah, because they were originally made by the Canon Corporation.
So,
not the camera company.
Right. XLR to RJ. And you know that this makes wiring your studio really fast. I use these all over the place. If you've got any of the audio over IP systems like Livewire, like Axia Livewire, you know that hooking the gear up with this will save you hours and hours and hours and soldering and bad connections, because you know these have good connections. They're not only factory made, but they're molded together and then tested. This is the kind that I like, because you can put any kind of any length of patch cable you want.
Well, and also they're good for changing, like if you need to go from, you know, XLR to tip ring sleeve.
Oh, yeah,
you know, or go male to male. You know, every once in a while you get in a weird situation.
Exactly.
For female to female.
But some people prefer this kind where you've got
same sex connections, Kirk, and they're legal in Ohio.
Then there's the other kind that already has the RJ45 male connector on it, and then, you know, whatever you want on the other end, XLRs, quarter inch, RCAs, you know, a bare wire if you need to solder it into something. So these are still available. They're available now through angryaudio.com. So if you go to the website, angryaudio.com, you know, Angry Audio makes a lot of widgets and gizmos to help make your studio builds easier. And now you can get Studio Hub compatible adapters from angryaudio.com. They've got a lot of them in stock right now, ready to ship, and more are on the way. So not much of an interruption in the availability of that. Thanks a lot, Angry Audio, angryaudio.com, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All righty, Chris, we're here with Frank Foti. And Frank is always ready with a story. And we're going to get to the high-end audio stuff in a few minutes. But Frank, you said that the anniversary or the birthday of mm-hmm. Z100 is coming up.
Yeah, it's August the 2nd.
6:08 a.m.
The radio station.
6:08 a.m. That's what Chris said.
At 6 a.m., that is correct. And, I mean, the bottom line was the company that I worked for at the time, which was Cleveland-based, Mallright Broadcasting, mm-hmm. had purchased WVNJ. And basically, all they really did was they purchased the construction permit, which allowed the movement of the transmitter from West Orange, New Jersey. It was at the same site as WFME. To the Empire State Building. And the crazy thing was we were supposed to go on from Empire on the 2nd, but due to a mishap in getting the combiner finalized, we had this, the first 2 days were actually from what Scott Shannon called the pea shooter transmitter in West Orange. And then it was actually on what would have been Thursday, August the 4th, when the quote unquote, the flamethrower went on the air.
Okay.
But yeah, the radio station launched at 6 a.m. on August the 2nd. And here's a fun little story most people don't realize, that before Scott came on, we were having to try to, and by the way, I need to give a shout out to a good friend of mine, Joe Knapp, who I was working with at the time at Maurite, and Jerry Westerberg. We were the three, let's say the three stooges, if you will, that in a short order of time got all that put together. And in essence, because we had to, at the last minute, meaning only like an hour to spare to get West Orange on the air, somebody had to be spitting audio. So technically, the first person on Z100 was me. And I remember Scott came in that morning getting ready to do the first show. And he's like, "Franco, we ain't playing the Kinks at 4:30 in the morning," because the Kinks, you know, I'm a big Kinks fan, Who fan as well, and Mr. Springsteen. But their big hit at that moment was a song called "Come Dancing." And I'm playing "Come Dancing" on the air. And, you know, Scott wanted it a bit more mellow. So, but yeah, Scott launched it. You know, it's pretty famous. If you go on the internet, there's it was a poor quality cassette copy, but you can hear it at 6 a.m. WHTZ signing on the air, you know, and time to get up.
So that first day of broadcasting, whether it was from the Pea Shooter or whether you consider the first day from the Empire State Building, were you in a studio that you had built for C100?
Well, yeah, technically what it was, we were in the room that became famous, but it was cobbled together equipment. Mm-hmm. And the first month or so, it was a small console. It was an old ITC 3D cart machine. Oh, wow. One.
Yeah.
You know, you run a CHR format.
Oh.
And I won't go into all the crazy details, but I was asked to be the chief engineer, and myself and Joe Knapp. Matter of fact, Joe found the cabinet maker, a guy in Milwaukee, and we basically said to Scott, "What do you want?" And Scott sat down with his cabinet maker with respect to how the studio was to be laid out, and they basically turned it over to me and said, "Put it together." And I did. And the story, Scott tells a story all the time, and I like to share it as well. I was in, I had like 1 week to get the whole thing wired up and running. And I'm in under the console, and Scott, in fact, had a big sign, do not go in there, leave Franco alone. So he comes in and he goes, "Franco, mark my words, we're going to make history right here in this effing room," you know? And I have to tell you, Kirk, we had no listeners, but I knew in my heart that radio station was going to be successful. And when that first book came out, which was January of 1984, and it was number one, I mean, I still get goosebumps thinking about it, but we knew it. We in our hearts knew we were going to be successful. And it's one of the best stories I've had the opportunity to be a part of. You know, this being the other one, worst to first yet again. But, you know, so tomorrow I'll have, you know, there'll probably be a moment I'll have, you know, my own little emotional tear, you know, to think back of what happened then and all those people. You know, I'm still very close with many of them to this very day. And I can honestly say to our industry that there is a piece of Z100 in everything we do.
In a minute, I want to get a couple of Chris Tobin's recollections of that first day and the first month and what kind of impact that, as a listener, Chris, and somebody in radio, but not at Z100, you had. But I want to ask Frank about that studio. So was there anything, you know, you did a lot of special things engineering-wise at Z100. A couple of things that hadn't really been done before. Obviously, one was audio processing, but also some telephony stuff. But what about the studio that you were building, the one that says, "Don't bother Frank"? Was there anything unusual about that studio, or was it just pretty well straight ahead, straightforward, you're going to build a studio that they could work in?
Well, the room itself was almost like a Pullman kitchen. It was narrow.
Oh.
And we had an interesting layout that gave the jock flexibility. And then, you know, the Z Morning Zoo, which was Scott and Ross in the beginning, there was a spot to the right of Scott where Ross was. So we had to do a few things so that Ross had the ability to do his thing. And then at the other end of the counter was where Claire Stevens and John Bell or J.R. Nelson would be. And every now and then, Anita Benita, who was the producer. And she, I mean, if ever there was anyone who knew more about finding information or prepping things, it was Anita. Matter of fact, she works at CBS AM now doing news. But in any case, for a small room, the things that that group accomplished was nothing short of a miracle. And basically, once we got it the way they wanted it and doing the things that it needed to be done, because Scott, to his credit, he liked everything very simple. Like, he wanted to hit one button that answered the phone and got the tape machine rolling for recording calls. And then they didn't want to have to flick any switches or do anything with regard to making sure that, you know, when the mic was off, you know, they weren't getting the air feed down the phone line. I mean, it was all that intricate stuff behind the scenes that they needed, which made it a good operating, you know, workflow, as we would call it today, for that staff at that time.
And these are things that consoles at the time didn't do naturally.
No, we did it all custom.
You had to custom all that. Yeah. Although nowadays, consoles that we make here handle all that internally.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And by the way, that the stuff that happens today grew out of those experiences, The ability, I remember back then, being able to have, we had six ITC-99 cart machines across in front of the jocks, and they wanted to have it. When they went into a spot break, each machine fired, cart one fired cart two, so that they could load up a spot break, the jingle and the next song, and walk out of the room and not worry about it. That wasn't stock stuff that was in audio consoles back then.
Hey, Chris Tobin, give us a moment of your recollection of those first days of Z100U as a listening consumer in the New York market.
There it is.
That would be the first thing. That would be the first thing people would remember. Well, I can tell you that when we heard about WVNJ switching formats and ownership change and whatnot, everyone in the market was definitely all ears. It was different because back then, I think, if I remember correctly, 97.1 WYNY was the top dog, the AC station in the market, because you could find them on every grocery bag back in the day. And they were the top dog. And then all of a sudden, there was talk of something called Top 40, or CHR, as I think it later became officially named. And when they went on the air, Z100 and the sound, I believe it was Eye of the Tiger was the first song, and then America, so Neil Diamond, and that pretty much set the tone. I remember working with a couple of people. Funny thing is, the college station I worked at, several of the folks I worked with tape editing, and we did a lot of stuff. We did Top 40 at the station, along with news and other things. We had all kinds of network stuff. They went on to work at Z100 years later. But we listened, and everyone in the room, just as you say, Frank, as you and Scott said, this is going to become something of the future. We sat there, and within the first 15 minutes, we all looked at each other and said, this is going to be a hit. I kid you not, I'm not pandering to anybody. We were a top 40 college station in Brooklyn, just having a good time. And here comes Scott Shannon and the crew. And we're like, whoa, we've been doing the same thing with new music, and they're doing it with pop music. And this is cool. It worked. And the people I'm talking about, maybe Frank may remember Spanky McFarlane. Does that ring a bell?
Oh my God. Spanky, may he rest in peace. No, really. Spanky was one of the most talented young guys I'd ever known. Spanky walked around. He had a book bag. And in his book bag, he had air checks of all the great disc jockeys for decades. And this kid, when he hit the radio, I'm getting goosebumps now because unfortunately he passed away from pneumonia years later. Yeah, but this kid was electrifying on the radio. And had he not become ill and lost his battle with pneumonia, he'd have gone on to have been a major disc jockey in New York or wherever he wanted.
I think you've got some audio to play here.
I think this will be fun for everybody.
I'm gonna hold the mic up. A very technical thing, a very technical move. Watch this.
Serving the universe from the top of the Empire State Building. WHTZ Z100 New York.
Ernie Anderson?
That is Ernie Anderson.
I thought so. Oh, wow.
Yep. That's the power the radio station had.
Hey, let's talk for a minute about the RF facilities. You said that for a couple of days you're on the pea shooter signal before right. you could get Empire State Building squared away.
Right.
What was it like in Empire State Building, getting that hooked up, being a new tenant there, I guess?
Well, yeah, we went into the Alford combining system and then the Alford antenna, and the Alford system was originally designed for 11 radio stations. Mm-hmm. And we were station number 12, and they didn't know if they could add a 12th station. Dr. Alford had, I think, was up in years and wasn't available to do the engineering work to see if a 12th station could be added. So we had brought in, and the antenna committee brought in Bob Silliman to, you know, and I'd later found out that Bob Silliman did a lot of the original engineering for the Alford antenna system. And it was determined that a 12th station could be added. And that combining system was known as an add one system. So it was Z100 diplexed in with, it was the country station at the time, 106.7. And then the output of that added in, I think, NEW. And so Z100 actually went through 11 combiners to get to the antenna. So we had to put out, I think, like 18 kilowatts out of the transmitter in order to get, you know, whatever the ERP was at, you know, what is that, 1,250 feet or something like that. You know, it's a class B station. But it did work. And considering all the group delay that our signal had to get through, you know, it ended up working out pretty well. And, you know, I mean, there's times now, and the thing that was always interesting is we had a backup bay on the ice shield, and whenever I'd switch to it, the sound of the station changed because of the change in the RF group delay.
Yeah, I bet. And it sounds like Z100 left a little bit of sidebands and heat in every filter along the way.
Probably still to this day. Well, I mean, the antenna system has changed.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a different antenna system, different combining system, but yeah. Just like East Wind, the locomotive, you know, it's like Scott Shannon used to say, you know, lock it in and get out of the way.
I understand that they've recently taken the Alford antenna down.
Yeah, they have.
Yeah. So that's a lot of memories there. But also, they Alford, groundbreaking as time, but it wasn't the best coverage for you.
Well, you have to remember, there were, I think, 12 or 16 dipoles around the building. So between each element, there for each frequency, there was going to be a scalloping null.
Right.
And each scalloping null was going to be at a different place because of different spots on the frequency. And Scott used to every now and then say, Franco, there's a parking spot at the Willowbrook Mall in New Jersey. I can't get Z100. You got to fix it. And I would drive. And he and I one time got my car. We drove out there, and we went to this parking spot. And, yep, you couldn't get Z100. And he'd say, you got to fix it. I'd say, Scott, I'll bet we'll find a spot where you can't get the competition, which was WPLJ. And sure enough, drove over. You know, they were not on the same antenna system. But, you know, it's just the craziness of FM coverage.
Yeah. Hey, we'd like to, since Frank does audio processing, I'd like to understand, you know, what was your motivation or your pressure to make the station sound as good as the content that Scott Shannon was producing? How did that dynamic go with Scott motivating you or you motivating yourself? What can I do to make this thing absolutely pop on the dial and complement the programming that Scott's doing?
Well, Kirk, that's a great question, and in many ways, it's kind of the motivation as to why I do what I do today. I was honored to have worked here at the top radio station here in Cleveland where I grew up, which was WMMS.
Okay.
And there, I had my mentor was a gentleman by the name of Jim Somich, and unfortunately, Jim, whose nickname affectionately was known as the Pooh Bear, isn't with us anymore, but the goal was we were going to sound the best on the dial and be the competitively as loud as possible on the dial. And our program director, John Gorman, and we had a great air staff, Denny Sanders, who, you know, worked with for years here at Telos. We all were on the same page with regard to how we wanted it to sound. They wanted competitive loudness, but no one wanted the audio to be crunchy,
right,
you know, or annoying. And so when Z100 went on the air, you know, you've got you know, you've got a format, CHR, where you wanted it to grab you. You know, the best, I've said this before in years past, I'll sum it up in the same way Roger Daltrey talks about The Who's music. And that is, it's like somebody punching you in the nose and saying, I love you. And that's the sound we wanted.
Yeah.
And so the quick story I'll try to share is that we went on the air. We had a Barefoot 8100. That was it.
Yeah.
And in New York, that was not going to cut it. And at the time, I'd been living in the Bay Area, and I knew that Bob Orban was working on what became the XT2 chassis. It wasn't out yet. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, I'll bet I can get one of those. And if it's not out yet, we'll hit the market with it. So I was in the Bay Area to move, and I reached out to a friend of mine, Jesse Maxinch, who was at Orban, and I asked him look, Jess, I'm at this new radio station, blah, 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 in New York. You guys want to put one of these units on? And he said, Frank, we'd love to, but Bob doesn't like to allow new product out of his site until it's released. So I went back to New York kind of with my head between my tail between my legs, because I didn't have the thing that I told Scott I would. And reason for the story is Scott goes, so what are you going to do? Well, that year I had seen the Texar Audio Prisms at the NAB. They were new, and made a phone call to equipment dealer at the time and asked if I could get a pair flown in overnight. Later that afternoon, I get a phone call from a guy by the name of Glenn Clark.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Glenn, may you rest in peace, dear friend. And he said, how soon do you want these things? I said, any chance I could get them there, get these things by tomorrow? And he said, well, how about if you could pick me up at the Newark airport later today, the old Allegheny Airlines, Glenn flew into Newark, had two units in his suitcase. We put them on the air. And, you know, the goal was to be competitively loud, but to allow the music and the elements, you know, like the jingles and everything, to just jump out of the radio. And I was allowed the freedom to do that. Scott, I think the way, and I was telling the story to somebody yesterday, Scott himself wasn't able to enunciate what he wanted. So what he would do is his radio buddies would come into New York on the weekends and do air shifts under fictitious names. And then they'd stay at his house and he'd go, Scott, I don't know what you guys are doing for processing, but man, the station sound, you know, effing great.
Yeah, yeah.
So Scott would come in here, Frankel, whatever you're doing in the audio processing, leave it alone. So that's what we did. You know, the goal was to be loud and proud, but to allow the, but to have a different sound. And I'll wrap the story up by saying there were a couple of listeners that ran their own private, like, surveys about content and programming and engineering. And they would rank all the New York City stations. And every time this little thing would come out, it would say, best audio quality in New York City. Number one was Z100.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Awesome. Awesome.
And I'm not just saying that.
It did jump right out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was married at the time, and my ex-wife, she hated this. We'd go walking through a mall. This is in the day where, you know, stores would play radio stations.
Right.
I could walk in the mall and go, and just by the audio, go, that's Z100. That's Z100. That's Y and Y, you know.
Similar formats, but you could identify the sound.
You know, I'd go in, if they were playing the Wimp, I'd say, you know, you're not going to have any customers today because you have the wrong radio station on.
Hey, we're talking to Frank Foti. I'm Kirk Harnack. We're live right now at the headquarters, the world headquarters of the Telos Alliance in Cleveland, Ohio. Tomorrow is the birthday of Z100, but we're also here to talk about audio processing, not just in the past, but what's coming up in the future and how the science of audio processing is really respected. A lot of Frank's work is getting some great reviews from some well-respected people in not only our industry, but in the recording industry, people who really know about great sound. That's all coming up. Chris Tobin is with us in New York, and will give us some more insights on audio processing these days in the city. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcasters General Store. Hey, this is the Henry Sportscaster from Henry. That's why it's called the Henry Sportscaster. This box is really amazing. The Henry Sportscaster will allow you to do a whole audio production on site at a sports venue, or hey, maybe a parade, maybe you do some complicated remote broadcasts, the Henry Sportscaster can really help you do this. You use the Henry Sportscaster either by itself or preferably with the Henry Sports Pods. The Sports Pods give your talent, you know, your play-by-play person, your color, your spotter, people up in the booth, gives them the ability to, hey, mute their microphone if they have to cough. It lets them control their own headphone volume control because it's got the headphone amp built into it. So the Henry Sports Pods and the Sportscaster work hand in hand. But what else can the Sportscaster do for you? Well, it provides exactly the right audio facilities for everybody involved with producing a sports broadcast, even if you're doing this for television. That's right. A lot of high schools and colleges are doing television broadcasts on their local cable system or streaming on the internet, and the Henry Sportscaster can really help you get this done. You've got a position for the producer. The producer can talk to the talent, can talk to the cameras, can talk to the field reporter, for example. You've also got inputs for a crowd mic, even a PA announcer mic you can bring in. You also have an external input to, if you've got some pre-recorded interviews, or maybe you've got a little video playback from a pre-recorded coach's interview or a special player, a star player. You can play those back and have it feed to everybody's headphones just exactly right. The producer can, again, as I said, talk to any of the talent, but also can tell the camera people what to do or the field reporter, hey, run down the field and get an interview with that guy who just got knocked off the field or just got taken out of the game and see how it's going. So that talk back is there. You can also have a cue bus to audition auxiliary sources to make sure it's queued up, it's the right thing to go. You don't have to unplug it, cue it up, and plug it back in. None of that mess. It's all built right in. The intercom just really makes it great because it's an intercom that's perfect for producing a sports broadcast. Or, as I said, a parade or a complex remote broadcast that your station may have sold, you can go out and get this thing done. It's just a one-rack unit box. It's easy to hook up. It's got all the connectors that you'd expect on the back and all the controls you'd expect in the front. Now, the Henry Sportscaster is available from our friends at Broadcasters General Store. They know all about it, and they either have them in stock or can get them right away. These are off the shelf and ready to go. Contact Broadcasters General Store. You can call them at 352-622-7700, or you can always go to their website at bgs.cc. bgs.cc. Talk to any of the really good folks there at Broadcasters General Store. My favorite place to go and buy broadcast gear, because they've treated me right for, I think, 30 years I've been buying from Broadcasters General Store. So check them out. Thanks a lot, BGS and Henry, for the Henry Sportscaster, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. Now, speaking of live productions, and I don't know that you use a Henry Sportscaster, but Frank, you're heavily involved with your favorite high school team.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that. Yes, I am. Being from the Cleveland area, I grew up. I graduated from a high school, Wycliffe Senior High School here in the Northeast Ohio. And myself and a fellow classmate, Mark Tennant, mm-hmm. we webcast the home football games for the Wycliffe Blue Devils. We've been doing it now coming up, I think, on about 15 years. And it's been last couple of years, the Blue Devils have made the playoffs. Matter of fact, the Blue Devils have had better records than the Browns, but, we'll see about this year. But no, the Blue Devils are looking, already. I was talking with a head coach a couple weeks ago, and we're excited about this coming year. And, I have to tell you, when it comes to high school, it comes to football, I love high school football first, then, college football with the Ohio State Buckeyes. By the way, there's a college north of Toledo that illegally uses the Wycliffe Blue Devil colors.
Yeah,
they like to say that they have maize and blue. So my class action lawsuit is going to get that college a brand new color, clear. And they've taken the Wycliffe Blue Devil W and turned it upside down. Gosh. And, you know. Oh,
gee. What infringement.
I know.
What are you going to do?
We're going to bring in Don Corleone.
You've got connections. Hey, let's talk for just another minute about New York audio processing. You know, it doesn't suit everybody's taste, and I don't know how involved you still are working with Scott or doing any processing there. What's your opinion on the state of processing in the Big Apple?
Well, you know, I think it's been – I think New York, as a market, has gotten a bad rap, you know. I mean, there was a time where it was pushed pretty hard. I will say that, you know, last few times I've been in New York and listened to the market for professional reasons. It sounded quite good, you know. I think it might just be a societal thing of like, well, you know, it's New York, you know, we got, you know, everything's tough in New York. Well, it is the number one market in the United States, and if not, probably the top market in the world. You know, in my international travels, I've had people where I've been to major broadcast facilities in London, you know, Paris, Italy, and, you know, the bumper stickers or the calendars that were up on the walls in those radio stations were from New York City stations, you know, be it Z100 or WNEW or, you know, stations of that matter. So, you know, when you're on the top, it's always easy to have somebody take a swipe at you. But, you know, to the comrades and the colleagues in New York City, I think they're doing a pretty good job, you know. I mean, with respect to, you know, the radio and broadcast engineering and with regard to audio processing.
Chris Tobin has a little bit a different challenge because he's playing jazz music there at BGO, right, Chris?
Yeah, we're full-time jazz, but my approach is, well, let's just say more along the lines of a very make sure you can hear the music while the top is down in the car on the turnpike. So I will say I'm not taking a traditional approach to the audio processing, and I know a lot of folks who enjoy the way it sounds. But I will credit that credit has to go back to the early days of Z100 when we on the market were introduced to something different, which was competitive audio and what it meant to sound a certain way and create a signature. And that's where things have gone. But the New York market has always been a challenge, and it's been a positive challenge for many. But, you know, back in the day when Frank started with the station Z100, I can tell you that I know I used to take an FM tuner. And I would tap into the IF section and use a scope and look at the IF of the received signal just to figure out how much clipping was taking place and how was the pilot doing and how dense was the audio. And the running joke would be, if you can walk on the square wave, you've got a loud station. And that was back in the 80s. And that, about, I know you people are laughing are like, what are you talking about? Today, with the digital processing world, you don't have to do this too much. It's very finite, very, not easy, but you can do a lot more and hear it quicker. Whereas back in the day with the analog stuff, you can have, and I used to say this to people all the time, a lot of folks in the market, we always kid about it because you could go to Z100 or PLJ, Larry Booger station, and you'd see the equipment rack and there was a curtain over the top of it. Oh, that must be the audio processing. And the running joke would be, look, I could have an 8100, two Texas, an XT2 chassis, and guarantee it will not sound like you're doing it because I have a different exciter at my transmitter, different antenna connection, different transmitter, different path, STL link. Maybe I'm using the old analog phone lines, you know, the equalized lines where you had a lot of roll-off that made it really cool to be able to do certain EQ settings because you didn't have to worry about spurious audio peaks because it was already done for you on the phone line. You know, the microwave links as well. So I think it's been a great time, and it continues to be. And it's the best part of audio processing, and, you know, with the Telos products, is that you can do so much. And it comes from a history. I mean, there's no doubt about it. If it wasn't for that August 2nd, 1983, I'm sure the audio landscape would be very different.
I think you're right, Chris. I think you're right. You know,
I'm serious.
I appreciate it. Thank you for saying that, by the way. And you know, the one thing, and then Kirk, this may tie into wanting to talk about where things are at today, is that, you know, one of the things that we've been able to do is, and this came about 10 years ago, because again, we were getting to a point with processing where it was getting pretty packed up. You know, we were pushing it, competitors were pushing it, and markets were getting real tight and tight sounding. And I'll never forget this. It was Omni was becoming 10 years old. And Paul McLean of Radio World asked me in an interview. He said, well, so what's next? You know, it's all packed up. You know, I don't know if you can do anything about it. And I said, well, you know, Chris, I'll be honest with you. I mean, as I listen to it, I think, you know, we've probably contributed. We've probably fed the monster, if you will. So the goal now has to be, how do you maintain the competitive level, loudness? I'm not trying to be politically correct, but we got to dial back, not the processing, but we need to bring quality back into it. So I embarked on a few years of study and realized that the problem, so to speak, was that the dynamic sections, be the compressors and limiters, and the final section, the clipping system, was generating just huge amounts of intermod.
Yeah.
And being able to get our arms around that took a lot of work. And the conventional methods that had been used up to that time didn't, you know, you could, it's almost like you'd get, it was like the water balloon, you know, you'd get one part working and then something else would break.
Yeah.
So it took some fresh thinking that where we were able to take that step forward. And I guess in a way I'm humbled because I made some breakthroughs and then I shared some of those with my colleague at the time, Corny. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, in fairness, a couple other colleagues who've done some good work in the same area too, Leif Clayson and Hans von Sutphen, we've all kind of tackled the intermod issue in different ways. And what we're able to do today is and this is why, you know, I see people in some of these dialogues on blogs or the internet saying, oh, you know, hypercompression is a bad thing. And I'm not saying that to promote hypercompression, but if you want to generate a competitively loud sound today, you can do it without the penalties that we've had in the past. And, you know, there's a, you know, to go into the lingo as to how that is, you'd probably have a bunch of people clicking off because it's there's a fair amount of there's some science and math behind it, but there's also some creative thinking behind it as well.
Moving into this era of processing, you know, and my first job with Telos was I put an Omnia FM or an Omnia FM Hot processor under my arm, and I went out to hundreds of radio stations, and we demoed as many stations as would let us. And then we came along. You came along with the Omnia 6, and you know, finally moved to the Omnia 11. But I always heard a processed sound, and I always thought you referred to a contribution by Cornelius Gould when he came out with the G-Force engine inside there. That resonated with me. My brain liked the way that it made the music sound. And I guess that's what the collaboration was about. Corny's ideas and making things musical.
Actually, in fairness, we associated a lot of G-Force with Corny because there were a number of his algorithms that were in that. But some of the basis of that came from the work that I did on the clipping system. And what I had done, Corny and I were, in a way, we did a lot of collaborating. And I've joked and said that we should probably do our own rock album cover in the way that Bruce Springsteen and Clarence Clemons had it on Born to Run. It should be Corny and I in a dark alley somewhere. Corny and I would sit and shoot the breeze like you and I are. And I would say, you know, Corny, I did the following things. And I was able to dial back or pull out intermod distortion. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll bet there's quotients of this that if we put it into the dynamic sections, you might be able to get some benefit. And he would, you know, I would share the design file with him. And then and Corny being somebody who always let a lot of things run in the background, he'd usually come back a few weeks later and go, hey, remember that thing you were talking about? Yeah. Well, I put it into the limiters. What? Listen to what it's doing now. And it's almost like, you know, you'd see bar graph activity, but you didn't hear the bar graph activity. Yeah. Yeah. And then he, you know, to his credit, he put that into the AGCs and he's like, wow, look, I'm able to raise the RMS level, but you don't hear the action of the RMS level. So it's the G-Force basically was the ability of tying all of these things in together. You know, it's not like they're all talking to each other, but the concepts that were developed here and shared among ourselves, you know, he factored it into it. And we called it G-Force because, you know, it's a play on his last name, Gould. And since the bulk of the, you know, processing architecture was a lot of things that he worked on, the AGCs, the limiters, and then getting all of that tied in together with the final limiter, which was my piece, We call the G-Force. It has a cool name, and it's worked really well. And I have to say that it's been astonishing just the feedback that people have had, you know, much the same as you just, you know, said.
The first time that I heard G-Force, and I was so accustomed to hearing FM processing, and the way that one of the innovations you came up with had to do with where the preemphasis was in the process.
That goes all the way back to the Vigilante.
Yeah, that goes way back. I wish we had more time, but I want to just mention that. Sure. And skip past it. That innovation did a lot for the openness of the high end.
Yes, it did.
Of the sound. It didn't sound all densed up and packed up. You know, a cymbal sounded like a cymbal,
right,
not like pebbles on a trash can lid.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
So when I first heard G-Force, my brain, here's what I listened to a song that I was really familiar with and that I loved. I think it was something by Fleetwood Mac. And I listened to it. And I thought, oh my God, that sounds the way that my brain always wanted it to sound.
Right.
There's nothing distasteful that the processing is doing to this sound. It's better than the original. And of course, lots of processing does that. But that was my moment that I thought, whatever this, whatever is going on in G-Force in terms of well, it's a lot more than just attack and release time. There's lot going on.
Yeah.
But whatever's going on, my brain goes, yeah, I like that. Yep. I like that.
You know, something I want to share with you, which ties into something else I wanted to share with your audience, and that is a couple years ago, I had the opportunity to spend time with a well-known recording engineer, producer, Grammy Award winner, a gentleman by the name of Frank Filippetti, who's in the New York City area. And Frank and I were having a chat one day about signal processing. And then he said, you know, Frank, there's certain distortions that the ear wants to hear. And the way he told me this story ties back into all of this. And Frank's probably, he's produced everyone from Pavarotti when he was alive to James Taylor, Carly Simon, among many. And he was doing a final mix on a well-known Carly Simon album, and she's at his studio, and they're mixing and EQing and mixing and EQing, and she's like, it's just not there. It's just not there. And finally she said, come with me. And he goes, why? He goes, come with me. And she took him out to her car. And Frank lives in the New York City area, and this is 1985.
Okay.
And she goes, I want my record to sound like this. And it was Z100. So Frank told me that story. He goes, look, he said, you know, even though we're both FF, he's FF1 and I'm FF2. He said, you taught me a lesson, even though we didn't know each other, because he said, the more I listened to the radio station, I realized that there were certain distortions, technically speaking, friendly distortions, if you will, that are good. And those are some of the things that happen and occur, which help give us the sound that people like.
Wow. Wow. Now, besides Frank, you also have been rubbing shoulders with a few other people in the recording business. What's that been like, and what have you learned from them, and what have they learned from you?
Well, thank you for asking, because it's something that I'm proud of. And that being, you know, the people in that side of the audio world, to them, audio quality and making sure that things are done as good as possible is paramount. And many years ago, you know, Steve Church and I would always talk about, you know, if there was going to be someone or in the music industry, you know, that would be critical, you know, that we could have them give us feedback on our work, who would it be? And independently, we both of us would say Steely Dan. Well, just by stroke of luck, thank you, Jason Tomlin, a member, you know, one of our colleagues.
Yeah.
Jason was doing some work on a technology called FIDEF, which is a whole other discussion in and of itself. But it's something, you know, if you're interested out there, look up FIDEF, F-I-D-E-F. And it's something, you know, it's an audio enhancement technology. And Jason began working with Gary Katz. Well, Gary Katz is the legendary producer of Steely Dan.
Right.
So through Jason, I got to know Gary, and Gary's had a chance to hear our stuff. He's like, you know, for what you guys do in broadcasting, this is the best I've ever heard. And I was sharing with Gary some other work that we'd been working on. And I said, you know, Gary, I could, you know, aside from yourself, I could use some critical feedback, you know, I mean, somebody to blow holes into what we're doing. He goes, I can do that. I can help you find it, you know, get those people. So through Gary, that's how I got in, was put in touch with Frank Filippetti. And a couple years ago, Gary and I went over to London, where we spent time in at Abbey Road, where our audience was Hugh Padgham, and Hugh was the engineer producer for everyone from XTC to Peter Gabriel, Phil Collins, Genesis, you know, The Police, Andrew Sheps, you know, Adele, Red Hot Chili Peppers. Yeah. And then, you know, when Giles Martin walks into the room, you know, his dad did, you know, what was that band? John, Paul, George, and Ringo, the Beatles. I can tell you with, you know, and I'm humbled by this. Every one of them were very complimentary of our efforts, you know, be it signal processing. You know, we were doing some things where we were trying to do some testing with FIDEF with signal processing and some other things that we've been working on. And that, you know, made me feel like, wow. I mean, and by the way, this isn't like this was the first time this fraternity was being made aware of broadcast audio processing. They knew who the other players were, you know, and they knew them by name. They said, you know, your stuff is head and shoulders above the rest.
Wow, what a compliment.
Yeah, you know, so you got to figure, you know, if the guy that did the records for Steely Dan you know, or the Police or is, you know, is now, you know, doing this, you know, remastering stuff for the Beatles is kind of giving you the thumbs up. I guess our efforts are doing okay.
And how many of us as broadcast engineers you have our favorite Steely Dan songs that we use as reference to set up processing?
I do that to this day.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Hey, we got we could spend hours here. We got a stop at the top of the hour here. It's Kirk Harnack. Chris Tobin is along with us too, listening patiently in Newark. Hey, Chris, you still there, buddy?
I'm still here. No, you're rid of me.
I love hearing these stories. Hey, tell you what, let's go ahead and take our last quick commercial break right now. When we come back, we're going to just have Frank give us a little bit of view of you know, where the future lies in audio processing, because we'll just have a couple minutes to wrap that up. So we're going to do that. You're watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech. It's our 454th episode, just here on the eve of the anniversary of the birthday of Z100 in New York. We're talking with the guy who made the audio processing for that, has come along with so many audio processing innovations since then, Frank Foti. We'll be right back after this.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavvo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while, so why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes. And enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavvo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavvo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavvo radio tech at www.lavvo.com/twert.
And thanks a lot to Lavvo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. That website is lavvo.com/twert. Hey, Chris, I figured we would take the last couple of minutes we have here in the show for Frank. We've been looking back a lot and looking at some recent history and some big names that have, you know,
given a thumbs up to a lot of the technologies and sounds that Frank and his colleagues have been doing. Frank, what do you think we're looking at in the next year, two, three for audio processing? We all know, it just really, there's no point in pushing for louder, louder, louder. It's quality and long-term listenability and the excitement that comes with listening to something that's well done. Where do you think we're going?
A couple things. One, we've got some things in the hopper that are that take it to the next step with regard to maintaining the competitive level and further maintaining or keeping the audio as clean as possible. I'm excited about some of those events. People are going to say, "Well, how soon can I stick it in my Volt or my 11. Well, those guys are pretty full up. But the other thing is too, is, we're looking at a paradigm shift in broadcasting, and we've been talking about it for a while. God love Steve Church and Greg Shea for inventing audio over IP. And I don't know if you can see, well, you can't see it, but sitting right behind me here is one of our new products, the Micro MPX.
We're able to
now transport the MPX signal over IP. Bit rate as low as 320 kilobits per second, and it's perfect. I shouldn't use the word perfect, but I'm going to. The integrity of the signal from point A to B, point A to point B, is right on the money with regard to peak control, everything that's there, and it's.
I did get to put Micro MPX on one of my stations overnight.
Right.
It's a prototype. They even yanked it out of my hands. No, we're not selling that one. We got to fix it up. But the technology is absolutely worthwhile. It's spot on, and it's going to solve a lot of problems for people. It's going to make my stations, it's going to make my life easier. This Micro MPX, that's a multiplex signal over IP at 320 kilobits per second.
As low as 320.
You can go higher.
The idea will be you can go from 320 all the way up to a linear connection, which obviously is much higher in data rate.
And so you got a few things you really can't tell us much about. I know a few details, and you said I couldn't even mention what I know. It's almost like we're going to have a day when the day of the box you screw in the rack, not saying it's over, but there's going to be other ways to do fantastic audio processing and get it to the transmitter.
Well, there's going to be some broadcasters that are going to want a box, and we're going to give them that.
Yeah.
There are people that are going to want it in the cloud or in a server farm or, some streamed application, but most importantly, and one thing I've not had a chance to say this during this thing, is at the end of the day, it has to sound great.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people out there touting, we can give you this utility, that utility. The listeners don't care about the utility items. It has to sound great. And knock on wood, we've been able to achieve that.
Well, when I first came to work here, or within the first few years, I would see you in your lab listening to the same 2.5 seconds of a Shania Twain song to get the algorithm exactly right.
Yep.
And I tell you, you can get all kinds of plugins to do processing in, Adobe Audition or in anything else, and it ain't the same. They're doing math. You're doing brain stuff.
This disc. It says Proc Tracks.
Proc Tracks, yeah.
Thanks to my colleague Mark Manolio and a few others, there's little segments on that that's the obstacle course.
And that's
the stuff that if that disc will pass through an algorithm all the way without anything breaking, then you've got something.
Man.
And yes, one of our longest employed John Granchi. John can never, ever listen to Don't Back Down by Tom Petty ever again. And it's my fault.
It's your fault. Hey, we got to go. Chris, thanks for standing by and giving us your impressions there in New York City. Any quick last words, Chris?
No. I mean, everything I understand and know and enjoy about the audio and broadcasting is definitely attributed to Frank and all the work he did back in the early 80s. I kid you not. And many of us here in the New York market, a lot of our talents come from learning, understanding, and saying, how do we push the envelope? And that's a credit to both Frank and what he's done with the company at Telos.
Oh, yeah.
Don't worry. That's right. Pepe's already taking care of the dinner.
Mover.
All right, we got to get out of here real quick. Frank, thank you so much for being with us. We could talk about this all day, and I wish we had the time. Hey, thanks a lot.
And thank you to everybody in your organization for allowing this to happen.
Well, we got to Andrew Zarian to thank, and he's up next on the live feed. Also, we have Suncast, our producer, to thank. He does a great job, and thank you, Suncast, for waking up early.
Doesn't he make potato chips?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sun?
Orange juice. Or I don't know.
Orange soda.
Orange soda. Thanks a lot. And Chris, thank you for being here and showing up at an unusual time. We got more stuff coming up next week on This Week in Radio Tech. In the next few weeks, got great stuff. Hope to have Frank Foti and some of his colleagues back again. I'm Kirk Harnack. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.